noted historian who will speak with us today about lessons from Lincoln and our collective past. First, we expect this call to last approximately 45 to 60 minutes. We'll have some introductions from Katrina, followed by brief remarks from Eric, a Q&A session, and then followed by a Q&A session where we very much like to hear from you. For those of you who have called in as well as logged into our web interface, you'll be able to submit comments and questions during the Q&A session via the chat feature, which is located at the bottom portion of your screen. For those of you who have only called in and not logged in on the web, we'll also be able to take your questions and comments over the telephone. I'll provide some more details about this right before our Q&A session begins. Everyone but Katrina and Eric will be muted during the presentation portion of the call, but those of you asking questions over the phone will be live once your call is selected. So now let me turn things over to the nation's editor and publisher, Katrina Vandenhuvel.
Thank you, Peg. I want to speak very briefly because I want to hear from Eric. Eric Foner, I could spend the whole call just extolling his contributions not only to the history of our country but to The Nation magazine and The Nation. Eric has been an extraordinary contributor not only to our pages but to how we think at the magazine about history, politics, society. It's fitting that, as Eric wrote in one of his last articles for The Nation, Our Lincoln, that Eric is such a central part of our editorial board. The Nation was founded by veterans of the struggle for abolition 3 months after Lincoln's death, and it has dedicated itself to completing, it did, the unfinished task of making the former slaves equal citizens. Eric has spent, I think he will tell us, he spent much of the month of February traveling this country talking about Lincoln and talking about how Lincoln has provided a lens through which Americans examine themselves. And in this extraordinary year with first African-American president, obviously there's a lot of thinking about looking at the collective past, and the questions raised by emancipation, as Eric wrote in his essay, continue to bedevil American society. The challenges confronting Barack Obama are those that will involve moving beyond the powerful symbolism of his election. And in his essay for us, Eric, and I'm sure he'll talk about this today, writes in very important ways about President Lincoln's relationship to the abolitionists and how he was moved by the movements of his time and what that means for our time. Eric is, in addition to being a valued member of the magazine's editorial board, is the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, one of America's, if not the greatest, historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And there are too many books to list, but it interests me that America had the good fortune to get a survey textbook from Eric. I believe it was 2004, Norton textbook, Give Me Liberty in American History. In 2000, he served as president of the American Historical Association. So with those words, I just would like to turn it over to Eric. And Eric, I think you know that we've had just an unprecedented outpouring of sign-ups for this call, and I think that's a measure of how much interest there is in history and lessons from history for these very transformative, turbulent times of hope and fear infused in roughly equal measure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Katrina, and a very kind introduction. And I'm very happy to be in this kind of high-tech, newfangled way of communicating and talking to so many Nation associates. I would have liked to invite everyone over to my living room for a nice little chat, but I guess that's not feasible. As Katrina said, and I do look forward, I'm not going to talk for that long because I do look forward to the opportunity to answer questions about Lincoln, if you want to talk about him, about Obama, although I'm not as much of an expert as many other people about what's going on today. I read the newspapers and The Nation, of course. And maybe the uses of history in understanding the present. But it's absolutely true, as Katrina mentioned, of course, we have just gone through, well, a month ago was the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln, February 12th, 1809. There was an extraordinary hoopla about this, some of it very illuminating and a lot of interest in the history, some of it rather perhaps superficial. President Obama himself has tried to channel Lincoln a little bit, identify himself with Lincoln. As you know, he launched his presidential campaign a couple of years ago in Springfield, Illinois. He, of course, was the senator from Illinois, a position that Lincoln twice ran for, desperately wanted to be senator, was more interested in being senator than being president, actually, for most of his career, but failed both times. So he comes from Lincoln's home state, and there are other comparisons one can make between Obama and Lincoln. I think, obviously, the Obama's election in some karmic way does seem to represent a kind of fulfillment of the promise of the Emancipation Proclamation, the promise of the destruction of slavery during the Civil War, and reflects, in a way, on Lincoln's own evolution. Lincoln, before the Civil War, was a man who shared many of the racial prejudices of his era. He grew up in, or he lived as an adult anyway, in Illinois, which was widely considered to be the most racist of all the northern states, had severe laws restricting the rights of black people, which Lincoln did not object to in the first part of his career anyway. But nonetheless, Lincoln grew out of this, and in the era of the Civil War and the course of the Civil War, Lincoln came to adopt a much broader view of the place of blacks in American society. He came to know distinguished black people like Frederick Douglass and others, and by the end of his life, he was really thinking seriously for the first time of the place of blacks in a future society without slavery, what kind of rights they would enjoy, what we would mean by equality in a post-slavery society. So I think, you know, Lincoln, what interests me about Lincoln, and I spent this morning writing a few pages of a book that I am working on about the evolution of Lincoln's views about slavery and race. I don't know when it'll be finished, but I try to carve out a little time as best I can while I'm teaching to work on it. But I think what interests me about Lincoln is precisely his growth. You cannot freeze Lincoln at one moment, and too many historians have tried to do that. There, I will actually make an analogy which might be surprising with Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. You know, every January we celebrate King's birthday, and we have on television the great speech he gave at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963. But, you know, I kind of feel we ought to maybe retire that speech for a while. Lincoln, King is forever frozen on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And King had a lot of other things to say during the course of his life, and especially in the final years of his life, about issues that didn't come up then, about economic inequality, about the need for really massive federal action to uplift the descendants of slaves and the victims of slavery and of Jim Crow and segregation and racism. We don't hear about the economically radical King on his birthday. And as I say, Lincoln tends to get frozen in sort of the middle of the Civil War. If anyone quotes Lincoln, they tend to quote his famous letter to Horace Greeley, where he said, you know, the Union is more important to me. If I could save the Union without freeing any of the slaves, I'd do that. If I could save the Union and free some of the slaves, I would do that. But, you know, Lincoln wrote that in 1862, but that wasn't his final statement on the subject, and his mature views later on really elevated the question of the destruction of slavery to an equal status with preserving the Union. It wasn't a subordinate or a secondary issue by 1863 and 1864 anymore. So that's what makes the writing of history interesting, trying to track out these unusual, the changes that go on, and the way Lincoln, and in a great crisis, the greatest crisis in our history, what really made Lincoln great was this open-mindedness and this willingness to change his mind and rethink his previous views. You know, this is something that our previous president, George W. Bush, let us say, didn't actually have that quality. He stuck with his ideas regardless of how disastrous they were and was unwilling to listen to any criticism. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens with President Obama He's only been in office for 2 months, as everybody knows. Already there are signs that some of his policies are perhaps being reconsidered, open to question. I hope so, in a way, that he has the statesmanship, like Lincoln, to rethink and to grow and to listen to critics, which is one of the things Lincoln did all the time. Now, of course, just yesterday or the day before, we noted the death of John Hope Franklin, the great historian, African-American historian, pioneer of African-American history. And Franklin wrote a great book on the Emancipation Proclamation back in 1963 on the centennial of the Emancipation, and really laid out, I think, very well the ways in which Lincoln's views changed in the course of his lifetime. But Franklin also, what interested me about Franklin, this may be slightly off the point, but Franklin never let himself become an icon of progress. In other words, he never let himself be trotted out to show how much progress had been made in race relations. Of course, he knew enormous progress had been made in the course of his lifetime. He died at the age of 94. As a young person, he witnessed the Tulsa race riot of 1921, where a whole black section of a community, including where his father worked, was burned to the ground by American terrorists, really, is what our homegrown Al-Qaeda. And he knew that doesn't happen quite anymore. But he wasn't willing to be brought out as a symbol of progress without reminding people how much still needed to be done. You know, he wasn't like Nelson Mandela, who kind of allowed himself to just be there as a symbol of black-white cooperation. There was always a bittersweet element that Franklin insisted upon, and I give him a lot of credit for that, even in very, you know, late period of his life. He wouldn't just sit back and rest on his laurels as a symbol of racial change. So, you know, when we think about Lincoln and Obama, I think those are the things we have to try to keep juxtaposed in our mind: the enormous progress from the abolition of slavery to the election of a black president. And nobody who knows American history can think anything but that this is a great watershed, given the tortured racial history of our country. And yet, it is not the end of race. You know, as some pundits say, it doesn't mean we've gone beyond race. It doesn't mean that race relations are finished with as an issue in American society, racial inequality. But it does mean that it's a new chapter open now in this long, complicated history. Lincoln doesn't give us the answers. We can't go back to the 1860s and say, what would Lincoln do? What would Lincoln say? By the way, whenever I lecture on Lincoln, people ask that question to me, and I always have to say, I have no idea what Lincoln would say today in the 21st century. It's not a question for a historian. It's more for a psychic, I guess. But we can go back to Lincoln and think about this historical process, how Lincoln related to abolitionists, for example. You know, Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He did not believe in the immediate abolition of slavery. He didn't hold the radical egalitarian views of abolitionists. And yet, he realized that their agitation, their effort, like the nation, to create a new public opinion, to push issues into the public agenda, into the public discourse, was essential to a politician like himself, that he couldn't do what he wanted without abolitionists out there generating the public sentiment that made it possible for politicians to act. And in a way, it's that dynamic between a open-minded and generous and forward-looking politician and mass social movements that is the great catalyst of social change in the Civil War era, and that can be and needs to be the catalyst of social change now in another crisis, a different kind of crisis, but still a real crisis for American society. So with that, I think I will stop because I do want to throw this open. I don't know quite how Katrina and Peggy will handle questions, but however they do so, I'm happy to respond to them.
Thank okay. you, Eric. Yeah. Thanks. So you'll field the masses of questions?
Right. Just shoot them out here.
Let me just lay down the ground rules one more time so people know how to answer ask their questions. For those of you who have logged into our web interface, and there are quite a few, you'll be able to submit questions and comments during this Q&A session via the chat feature. For those of you who've only called in, we'll be taking your questions and comments over the telephone. If you're interested in asking a question, just press the star key on your phone and you'll be added to our question queue. If you're selected to ask a question or make a comment, you'll hear a chime tone right before being connected live. Once you hear that chime, I will read the last four digits of your telephone number and we'll call on you, and then please just tell us your name and where you're calling from. Please keep your questions and comments brief, on topic, and to the point, no longer than a minute or so. The log will remind you to move towards wrapping it up. Apologize in advance if we're not able to get to every single question or comment. And finally, we invite you to send us an email at rsvp@thenation.com if you have any additional comments or questions that we're not able to get to. We also invite you to write to us to let us know how you found the whole conference call experience. Again, if you're on the phone and you want to ask a question, all you have to do is press the star key on your phone and you'll be added to the queue. The first question we have is a chat question from Charles Strickland. And his question is, what can Obama learn from Lincoln, who persistently sought reconciliation with the South without surrendering his principles on slavery? I think Obama has persistently pursued reconciliation with Republicans without surrendering his principles on the class system in the United States.
Well, that's a good question. Lincoln was not a believer in what we hear today, bipartisanship. Lincoln was a Republican, and that is how he ran his White House, and he did try to bring Democrats into the Republican Party, so-called Union Democrats who were willing to support the administration, but Lincoln did not believe in bipartisanship exactly the way it is phrased today. That is to say, surrendering some of his principles in order to get votes from the opposite party. So obviously if you are the president in a war, as Lincoln was, a titanic war, and as Obama is with smaller wars, you try to generate as much public sentiment in support of your administration as you possibly can. So Lincoln did that, obviously, and tried to gain at the lowest common denominator, so to speak, of public support. But he never forgot that he was a Republican. He was elected as a Republican. The Republican Party had some basic principles that he was never going to compromise. Now, on this question of reconciliation with the South, that's a perfectly legitimate point. And, of course, in his second inaugural address, Lincoln spoke of malice toward none, charity toward all, binding up the nation's wounds, which is a noble sentiment. And yet he also understood that the South is not a unit. There was the White South and the Black South, and, of course, divisions even deeper than, even more complicated than that. The real problem was, how could reconciliation with the White South be made harmonious with justice for the Black South? Lincoln never quite figured that out. He died just at the beginning of the Reconstruction era, where this was the fundamental problem that faced the country. We don't know what he would have done in Reconstruction, but I think it's quite fair to say that he would not have simply surrendered the rights of black people the way his successor, Andrew Johnson, did in order to seek reconciliation with the White South.
Okay, thanks, Eric. We're going to take a telephone call, and this one is from area code 508. Area code 508, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is William Beckett, and I'm calling from Ashland, Massachusetts.
Hi, William. What's your question today?
Okay. I'll make it brief, and I want to preface it so that you understand where my question is coming from. During the Civil War, the South lacked stockpiles of heavy weaponry as compared with the Union Army. They were really deficient in this area. They made numerous attempts to stockpile it from other outside nations. As the Civil War progressed, it turns out that, and this is changes the theory of the reason behind the Emancipation Proclamation, it turns out that Lincoln got width of the operations that the Southerners had started up, industrial operations in Birmingham, Alabama. And they had, Birmingham is rich in iron ore and also coal. And they had built several large mineral converters to start manufacturing weaponry. Principally, these were field mortars. And this was just before Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation, because as part of that Southern weaponry manufacturing, they were using slave labor, not only, you know, for the processing of the metal, but also of making the mortars themselves. And so I would just like to get a comment from the doctor as to this particular theory, as to what might have caused Lincoln to issue his Emancipation Proclamation.
Right. Well, the Emancipation Proclamation is what we call in the lingo of the academic world sort of overdetermined, which in English means there were just a lot of causes for it. And there's no single cause. There are many, many ones. There was the fact that the traditional method of fighting the war the first year or so was not working, making it just of army against army. Lincoln realized it had to be a war of society against society, undermining the basic economic infrastructure of the South. Now, I don't know about this particular thing. Birmingham, by the way, was not founded until the 1880s as a city, but presumably they did know that there was coal and iron ore there in that region. But you know, I think you can expand the point a little more and say slave labor was critical to the war effort of the South in many, many ways, many, many ways. It was slave labor that was feeding the Southern armies. It was slave labor that was doing a lot of manufacturing, not just in Alabama, but the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond, which produced most of the iron, you know, these weaponry for the South. So, yeah, the desire to deprive the South of slave labor in any part of the South was important for the Emancipation Proclamation. But, you know, one of the ironies is the South did succeed, the Confederacy did succeed during the war in creating a kind of, I don't even know what you call it, slave socialism. The government owned and set up and ran arms production facilities all around the South. And, in fact, they were pretty successful at it. When Lee's army surrendered in April 1865, they had run out of food, but they still had plenty of weapons. So it didn't seem like getting weaponry was a problem for the South during the Civil War. So this is one, perhaps, angle, but I think one would have to take a much broader view to get a full picture of the all the reasons, all the complicated reasons for Lincoln's shift toward emancipation as a Union policy.
Okay, thanks, Eric. We have a chat question from Eric Strand, and his question is, does Eric feel that Obama has the same ability to change his mind on important questions as he sees them unfold, specifically Afghanistan?
We shall see. That's a great question, and I certainly hope so. I believe I am vaguely encouraged by his comments the last couple of days about Afghanistan, what he said on 60 Minutes the other day about how we need an exit strategy. In other words, you know, Bush's policy was endless war forever in that region. Bush never talked about an exit policy, an exit strategy, so I'm encouraged that Obama said that. I noticed today Obama said that we are not just giving a blank check, we're not trying to be there forever. You know, now, we don't know if this is just rhetoric or what, but I certainly hope that he is open to criticism, and I think to criticism of this policy, and I think he is smart enough to know what happened to President Lyndon Johnson and his domestic plans and how they were torpedoed by the by the Vietnam War, how his entire presidency was destroyed by the Vietnam War. And, you know, so I don't know. I think if we ask that question a year or so from now, we'll know. It's a little too early to ask Obama to change his mind when he hasn't even put all his policies out yet. But, if he's going to learn anything from Lincoln, I think that's what he better study in the history.
Okay, great. We're going to take a telephone call from area code 704. Area code 704, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Wesley McLeod. I'm calling from Matthews, North Carolina. And I was going to ask Dr. Foner if he'd ever heard of the, speaking of Tredegar Ironworks, there's a very humanistic statue of Lincoln and his son Tad on a park bench that was dedicated about 3 years ago. I was there with my son, and they had these Civil War reenactors protesting. It was a really interesting event. But anyway, it was very inspiring to be there, and I was wondering if you were familiar with that.
Well, I've read about it. I have been in Richmond quite a few times, but not in the last 3 years since that statue was unveiled. I know that there are some diehard neo-Confederates who do not think a statue of Lincoln ought to be in Richmond. You may remember that some years ago there was a lot of protest when a statue of Arthur Ashe, the black tennis player, was put up in Richmond near their avenue of Confederate heroes, you know. But I think Richmond is changing. It has changed. And I don't want to take the... after all, Obama did carry Virginia in this election. Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy. There still are some people who haven't quite accepted the result of the Civil War. But, places like the Tredegar Ironworks itself is now a national park site with a very excellent exhibits on the Civil War. The Museum of the Confederacy, which is in Richmond, which is notorious or infamous for even now having a annual Confederate ball where people come dressed up in Confederate uniform and Southern Belle dresses as a fundraising thing. Some people think this is somewhat poor taste. But on the other hand, the Museum of the Confederacy has had excellent, excellent exhibits over the past 10, 15 years on the history of slavery, the role of blacks in the Confederacy, the role of blacks in the Civil War. So I think Richmond has a broader outlook now than perhaps the protesters at that unveiling of that statue might suggest. But I do hope one of these days to get down there and take a look at it with my own two eyes.
Thanks, Eric. Okay, we're going to take another phone call. This is from area code 805. Area code 805.
Yes, this is Barry Price, and I am in Shell Beach, California.
Hi, Barry. What's your question today?
First, I want to thank Dr. Foner for his time. This is really a privilege. I would like to know whether you feel, it seems that President Obama has handed the keys to the economic hen house to the proverbial foxes who created this problem to start with. And I'm wondering what your perspective on this is and whether you feel that he recognizes that, and if so, how long it will take him before he drives out the foxes and some progressives.
Well, first thing I should say is you and others should communicate that point of view to the White House. You know, the Obama administration is very keen on hearing from people, whether it's on the internet, email, other ways. And I believe the key thing is to make clear that a lot of people feel exactly what you do. Now, I am not a scholar of economics, certainly modern-day economics. What I know comes from reading William Grider and others in The Nation, Paul Krugman in The New York Times, my colleague here at Columbia, Joseph Stiglitz. All of them fundamentally say the same thing that you just said, that right now the economic policy is somehow not coming to grips sufficiently with the underlying problems, the underlying disaster of the last 10, 15, 20 years of economic policy and action, and that they seem to still think that just pouring money into banks will let things go back to the way they were before this, which I think is not what we really have in mind. It is absolutely true that people like Summers, that Geithner, some of these others, have a lot to answer for in terms of how we got into the boat we're in right now. So You know, I really don't know what to say, though, about what's likely to happen and what Obama's likely course will be, but I think, you know, he chose these people, and it's probably not realistic to think he's going to boot them all out anytime soon. But again, I think it requires pressure from people like Congress. There are many voices in Congress complaining exactly along the lines that you suggested, and from people out in the country who try to make it clear that the current direction of the economic policy, although it has some positive virtues, is really not adequate to the current situation.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to take another phone call. I've got quite a lineup here. This is from area code 407. Area code 407. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Mohammed Chowdhury, and I'm calling from Davenport, Florida, a little town to the south of Disney World. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
Yeah, my question is, do we know where we stand? We are entangled in this economic crisis, but we don't, you know, put ourselves, our country, besides China, India, and other economical powers in the world. And while we are entangled in this mess, these countries are looking forward and moving forward, and basically we are just lagging behind. So what is it that these, for example, the other side, the Republicans, are waiting for if they have better programs, you know, to help this country move forward? If Lincoln took a drastic measure, a huge decision, and that's, I'm quoting from a little magazine here, as a matter of fact, this is a 200, you know, by Centennial Collector magazine from the Smithsonian. This is just a quick quote here, and it says, "I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper," he said. "If my name ever goes into history, it would be for this act, and my whole soul is in it." These are Lincoln's own words. Basically, that decision it took some thought, and definitely, you know, it paid for it.
Yes, of course, Lincoln did say that when he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, at least according to some, you know, a lot of Lincoln's words that we think are his words are actually the recollections of other people, perhaps accurate and perhaps not, but I think there's good reason to think that he said something along those lines. I feel hesitant to answer your question because I'm not an economic policy person. I'm not so sure China is moving ahead all that fast right this moment. I think China is facing serious economic problems as well as the United States because of the collapse of its exports, because of the world recession. India, I'm not 100% sure about, but certainly, you know, in the globalized world, every country is connected to every other one, and nobody can be immune from the financial crisis that has swept the globe. The Republicans don't seem to have any policy. I don't think waiting for them to come up with something is going to amount to anything because all they say is no, 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 and basically, as they have made clear, they just want Obama to fail. In fact, they don't want to put forward a policy that may succeed. They want to blame him for failure. But I don't, you know, as I say, I think you should probably pick up the recent issues of The Nation and read William Grider and read some of the editorials, and indeed other articles, because The Nation has over the past month or so put forward several excellent articles about what needs to be done. I hope Obama is reading The Nation. Lincoln did read a lot of periodicals and newspapers. He tried to keep abreast of public sentiment, which at that time was expressed through newspapers, before radio, before TV, before internet. It was newspapers that were the carriers of public opinion. I hope Obama is reading The Nation and other such journals to get a sense of options that may be out there that haven't been tried yet.
Thanks, Eric. We've got a chat question somewhat along the same lines. It's from Bert Silverman, and his question is the Lincoln paradigm at all relevant in a totally changed economic system, a world economic destruction and an environmental crisis? In other words, far more powerful forces blocking progressive change.
Well, Bert, I know Bert. He lives next door to me here, so he could have, he could have walked over and asked me to come. Now, the point is, of course, Lincoln is living in an entirely different world, an entirely different economy. The world of Lincoln, and really the world he grew up in, was the world of the small farm, the small shop, the craftsman, the independent artisan. That's the world Lincoln really thought was threatened by the expansion of slavery. And, you know, one of the great ironies of the Civil War is, unintentionally, the war gave a tremendous boost to the very economic forces that would eventually undermine Lincoln's America, the forces of industrialization, of financial consolidation, and things like that. The very effort to mobilize the resources of the nation to fight this war really, as I say, promoted economic consolidation, which in the late 19th century meant that Lincoln's world of small farms and small shops was really in a very beleaguered state. So no, we cannot look back to Lincoln for direct answers to the questions we have today. I think what we look back for is a sense of how politics may work, a sense of how change comes. What are the catalysts for radical change? And second of all, you know, just to see how what is leadership? What is great leadership? You know, what are the qualities that one is looking for in leaders? So it's less a question of specific policies than the nature of radical politics, which is what the nation, I think, stands for and historically stood for. And, you know, how should we operate? You know, Katrina has often heard me say this. My model of how we ought to operate is the abolitionists. They kind of had it figured out back 150 years ago in terms, in a democratic society, what should radicals do? You put forward principled positions, you put forward alternatives, you try to work on public opinion, you try to change the nature of public discourse, and that's how you influence politics. You know, the abolitionists had a very, very well thought out theory of political agitation. During the Civil War, some of them got involved in partisan politics and were not very good at it. Lincoln was a much better politician than Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison. That wasn't their job, and Lincoln always outfoxed them. But in terms of thinking up new ideas and putting forward new perspectives and trying to use that as your way to influence the public sector, I think that's what we can learn from how the whole spectrum of anti-slavery sentiment that was pushed forward in the mid-19th century.
Okay, we're going to take another telephone call. This is from area code 973. Area code 973, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Okay, Mark Tolpin from New Jersey. And I'd like to hear some thoughts apropos the approach to residual racism, which unfortunately isn't as residual as we might hope. People tend to think of the Civil War as having been an agrarian society versus a industrializing society, and with distinct borders. But as you pointed out so well, Illinois was the nexus of a large amount of racial tension during that period. And even today, Indiana is probably one of the leading KKK states in this country. Now, given the fact that the South was exposed, if you will, whereas the North was able to, in some ways, skirt the issue, and perhaps even allow worse things to survive than celebrating Sherman's March and so forth, which occasionally goes on still down in the South. How do you think, or do you think there's a different approach to more hidden racism in the North than, and a different approach for that relative to the South. I'll point out also that the same company in Cincinnati, Ohio, made the uniforms for both armies.
Well, you know, obviously that's a very important question. I think one has to really start thinking about what exactly is the problem of race nowadays. It's not an easy question to answer. We are obviously not living in the era of legal segregation. We're not living in the era of Jim Crow disenfranchisement. I would actually say that at the current moment, given the economic situation, the most devastating thing that has happened to black people in the last 20, 30 years has actually been deindustrialization, which is not a racial policy. It's been a policy pursued by the Reagan, well, Carter, really. It started with Carter. Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, all of those people were pretty much the same, in my humble opinion. I know Clinton wouldn't believe that, but in terms of their economic policy. And deindustrialization has destroyed a great deal of the black, you might call, solid upper working class, the people who had good jobs and good industry, where they only got them late, you know, into the 20th century through the civil rights movement and everything. And that has had a devastating effect on black communities. That's not a racial problem in its origins, because it affects large numbers of white people too, of course. But I think the best thing that could be done for black America today would be for the country and Obama to adopt a sort of industrial policy to rebuild the manufacturing base of this country, which has been devastated by the shift toward finance and other things, and by economic globalization and the shifting of jobs overseas. Now, that doesn't deal with, you know, the psychology of racism, you know, bigotry, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, in a way, Obama's election demonstrated that race is not the sole mode of identity of people. If people can overcome or forget about race for the moment, if they feel they have common interests. The people who voted for Obama were not all believers in human brotherhood, you know, but they decided that their interests were better served in a serious economic situation by voting for this black candidate who seemed to have a better grasp of the situation than McCain, and therefore racial views didn't really end up determining how the large numbers of these people voted. And I think that's, in a sense, in an odd sort of way, I think the best way to deal with race is to create common interests which transcend race. And therefore, that creates the possibility for cross-racial political alliances and economic alliances, which don't require one to deal with, you know, the psychology question, and really are more down to earth in terms of what can we do that will benefit all people in the society, and therefore blacks and whites and Hispanics all together.
Great, Eric. We've got a chat question from Maura Stevens, and she writes, Dr. Foner, in a book review in The Nation recently speculating about what might have been the cost of not having had a civil war, you wrote, quote, in other words, the price of peace would have been a different harvest of death, the death of freedom of speech, political democracy, and any hope for an end to slavery, end quote. Would you please elaborate a bit on how you concluded that all compromise proposals being discussed in Congress in 1860 and 1861 were untenable, making war inevitable? Do you think people were too ideologically divided then to find any common ground and avert war? And do you think U.S. Americans are too ideologically divided now to find common ground and work for common good?
Aha. Well, that's a very good question. Historians have been debating this ever since the Civil War began, I guess, so it's kind of hard to summarize. That review was a review of a book by Drew Faust, who subsequently, or perhaps at that time she'd already become, yeah, I guess she was already the president of Harvard, so I give her a lot of credit. It's not that often that a distinguished historian becomes the president of one of the great universities in the country. Nonetheless, like any historian, her book is open to some criticism. And what I was trying to point out was simply that you know, her book focused so much correctly on death and destruction as what war really is. We sometimes tend to romanticize war, to think of it as a gallant struggle. Maybe we don't anymore, given what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, but there often is a tendency to do that. And as she's pointing out, no, what is war is just death and murder and et cetera, and pointless. And although I agree with her that we shouldn't romanticize war, I was trying to raise the question of, you know, avoidance of war sometimes also can lead to problems. Now, was war inevitable in 1861? No. They could have come up with some compromise, no question about it. They have had compromises in the past. I think the bigger question is, could slavery have been abolished in this country peacefully? And the answer is, I don't see how it could. There were innumerable efforts between the American Revolution and the Civil War to put forward proposals for the gradual, peaceful abolition of slavery. Nobody in the South accepted any of those proposals. Lincoln himself, as soon as the Civil War began, went to Delaware and said, Delaware had about 1,800 slaves, it was tiny, and he said, look, let us buy your slaves, and we'll pay you whatever you want, basically, and we'll even colonize them outside of the country so you don't have to have free blacks around, which we know you don't want, and this will start the ball rolling for emancipation. And look, obviously, slavery is not that important in Delaware, 1,800 slaves, you can give up your slaves, and we'll pay you. Delaware said, forget it, you don't understand, Lincoln. It's not the money we're interested in, we want our slaves. We want to be slave owners. Slavery is different. If it was railroad stocks, they would have said, yeah, sure, we'll buy, and then we'll buy some other stock. What difference does it make if I own railroad stock or bank stock or something else? But slavery is different. Slavery is a way of life. Owning slaves is the form of identity of these Southern slave owners. They did not want to give up their slaves. Now, Delaware, in the end, lost their slaves without any money. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. They didn't get paid a penny. So it shows, you know, even in the best of circumstances, there was no evidence that slave owners were willing to voluntarily surrender their slaves. So, you know, they could have had a compromise in 1860, and what would have happened in 1865 or 1870? There would have been more, you know, there was an ideological conflict in the country. There were economic conflicts. There were political conflicts. They all came to revolve around the question of slavery. And, you know, although this is what we call counterfactual history, it's hard to, you know, you might say, well, would slavery have still existed today if there hadn't been a civil war? Well, possibly not. But how we would get from there to here is very hard to put forward a reasonable, plausible path to the peaceful abolition of slavery in this country. So, you know, David Potter, a great historian, ended one of his books on this period by simply saying, when the Civil War ended, secession was dead, slavery was dead, and 620,000 people were dead. He just left it at that. And what he's basically saying is, you decide. It's not a historical question. It's a moral question. Which is more important, the end of slavery or the death of 620,000 people? Was it worth it? Well, that's, as I say, that's not a historian's question. And anyone can answer that any way they want. But as I say, it's hard to see what the real alternative was.
Eric, Maura just had a quick follow-up point she wanted to make. She said, I wonder if you've ever watched Kevin Wilmot's excellent 2006 mockumentary about what might have happened had the South won the Civil War.
Oh, CSA. You know, I never have seen that. I ought to go down to Blockbuster or somewhere and rent it. I've heard about it. My students have told me about it. It's sort of based on the South winning the war. There have been a lot of, what do we call it, you know, fictional history or that kind of thing on what would have happened if the South had won the Civil War. Usually, these kind of things end up with the South abolishing slavery anyway within a few years, which I think is utterly implausible. Yeah, I think it's probably worth seeing, but I haven't seen it yet.
Great. Okay, we're going to take a couple more phone calls. We've got about 10 minutes left. This is a call from area code 517. Area code 517, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
This is Richard Currier from Grand Ledge, Michigan.
Hi, Richard.
And
what's your question today?
Well, first I want to make a comment, Eric. I'm glad you're working with the nation. And I think the nation is really the number one spokes instrument for progressives in America.
Absolutely.
My question is, Lincoln was assassinated, and Obama is trying to get out and be in the public as much as possible, and I'm scared to death.
Well, that's not a question exactly. I understand where you're coming from, and obviously we've had a number of presidents assassinated in our history. All I can say is, Obama has made the decision that he is not going to just sit in the White House in a bunker and protect himself. He has a Secret Service, which I assume is professional, competent people. Most presidents say, look, if you have a determined assassin, it's very hard to completely protect the president. But I think, this is his style. One just has to do whatever you do. If you pray, keep your fingers crossed, hope, whatever, that such a thing would not happen. But I wouldn't advise Obama to just stay in the White House and not go anywhere, because in a sense he needs to be out and listening to people and interacting with people to hear the anger and frustration that exists in this country now, and to hear how much dissatisfaction in some ways there is with the steps that he's taken so far. I mean, dissatisfaction that he hasn't even done more than he has. And so I think it's important for him to be exposed to these points of view in a way that a guy like Bush never was. Bush only went to, by the end of his presidency, Bush could only go to army bases, right? That's the only place he could go without knowing there were going to be demonstrations and opposition. And so he never was in contact with anybody who held an alternative point of view.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions. The next one is from area code 415. Area code 415, can you
yes,
hear me?
Hi.
Hi,
hello?
Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, thank you. My name is Rhonda McGee. I'm calling from San Francisco. Thank you very much, all of you, for hosting the call and to the distinguished professor for spending the time. I'm curious to hear a little bit more of your thoughts about the unfinished business of Reconstruction. And there are two ways that I'd be interested in hearing you comment on it. One, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the relationship between that, the state of the teaching and substance of what we teach about history, and how that relates to the situation we find ourselves in with regard to the unfinished business of Reconstruction. And then another lens to which I'd be curious to hear you speak about this is the lens of immigration and labor. And there's a way in which, for me, and I have to admit I'm working and writing and doing a little bit of research on this as well, there may be a link between the kinds of commitments we made to slavery, the lifestyle that you just referenced that was, distinctive around slavery, and the way in which we still struggle with what to do about immigration and, cheap, exploitable, racialized labor.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if there's any, certainly drawing on your experience in looking at the historical record, which I haven't seen, I'm curious if you are aware of any links.
Well, that's a great question. A couple of questions, and like most of the questions we've had today, a full answer would require a very lengthy discussion because they're weighty questions. I have, as you suggest, written a lot in my scholarly work on the Reconstruction period, which followed the Civil War. I think this is a critical moment in American history because it's the time in which, for complicated reasons, the government, the country, the victorious North, made a commitment to this principle of equality, which had never existed before in American history. Equality for all citizens, equal rights, equal opportunities, regardless of race. It put that principle into our Constitution and our laws. And it didn't only apply to black people. It applied to everybody. It was catalyzed by the abolition of slavery, of course. But, the principle of birthright citizenship, for example, which is in our 14th Amendment in the Constitution, that anybody born in the United States is an equal citizen. That applies to the children of immigrants, as you well know.
regardless of the status of their parents, the children of illegal aliens or illegal immigrants born in the United States are American citizens. That's because of Reconstruction. Without Reconstruction, that principle would not be operative today. So, of course, Reconstruction was part of the end of slavery, in the view of the people who had abolished slavery, was to create this system of what they called free labor, of genuine opportunity. You know, Lincoln said in the Emancipation Proclamation that these former slaves should go to work for reasonable wages. He didn't just say go to work for wages, reasonable wages. And, you know, many people feel that the way immigrant labor, as you know, or many other kinds of labor are treated in this country are no longer in keeping with that principle of reasonable wages. And that's a violation of the conceptualization of what freedom really is or ought to be in the United States. So, you know, again, obviously, it's 150 years later. The racial configuration of the country is entirely different. The Hispanic population is far, far larger than it was at that time. The Asian population, we're not in the old black-white template anymore. We have a much more complex racial situation. But I think these questions of labor, the rights of labor, and the opportunities of labor are still very much on the agenda today, and your research, I'm sure, illustrates that. And again, we can't go back to Reconstruction and say, well, what would they have done now? But I think it's to go back and try to find some inspiration in those broad humanitarian principles that were put into our Constitution and laws at that time, and which have been grievously violated for so many times in the period after Reconstruction came to an end.
Thanks, Eric. All right, we have time for just one more question. It's a chat question from Brian Harding, and he says, to what extent do you feel Lincoln's expansion of presidential powers curtailing civil liberties during wartime set a precedent for our most recent global war on terror?
That's a great question. There is a scholar at Daniel Farber, a law professor at Berkeley, I believe, who wrote a book a few years ago exactly about this, Lincoln's Constitution. Now, it seems like in war, any president tries to expand the powers of the presidency. And Lincoln certainly acted in certain respects, as he himself said, beyond the Constitution. The suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, suppression of some opposition newspapers, some arbitrary arrests. No question, Lincoln claimed under what they called the war power, which today we call the power of the commander-in-chief, claimed to be able to take steps which in ordinary times would not be allowed constitutionally, and indeed many people felt they shouldn't have been allowed even during the Civil War. And I think this is an area where Lincoln is justly open to serious criticism. I think we need to remember that the country was in a crisis of its own existence. You know, the future of the nation was at stake in 1861 to 65. That is not the case today. Whatever one thinks of Osama bin Laden and these guys, and of course September 11 was a terrible thing, it did not threaten the existence of the American nation. There's no way that Al-Qaeda can overthrow the government of the United States or anything like that. Now, that does not justify what Lincoln did, but I think it suggests that perhaps whatever justification might exist then is much less viable today. But it is certainly true that the precedents build up. Lincoln's abuse of arbitrary power, Woodrow Wilson's in World War I, arbitrary arrests, suppression of civil liberties, even Roosevelt in World War II with the internment of Japanese Americans. War concentrates power in the hands of the president and generally leads presidents, no matter what party they're in, to feel the Constitution is a sort of an inconvenience, that it's much easier to fight a war if you don't have to worry about the Constitution. Now, the one thing I'll say about Lincoln is he acknowledged what he was doing candidly, and he went to Congress and he said, look, I face this problem. I have gone beyond the Constitution. Here's my reasons for doing so. Bush never did that. Bush just never talked about it, or just said, no, everything I do is constitutional. The president can do anything he damn well pleases, and no one can say anything about it. So he wasn't even willing to have a discussion
of the arbitrary actions that he took. So I give Lincoln more credit for at least being candid and making clear that he had faced this choice, and here's why he made these decisions. But there's no question that the precedent is an alarming one, and it can certainly be abused and has been abused many times since Lincoln's presidency.
Thanks, Eric. Katrina, I think that's all we have time for today.
I suspect that we could go into the late evening through sunrise. Eric, I want to thank you for your extraordinary insights and inspiration. Also for reminding us of what we do here at The Nation week in, week out, day in, day out, which is, as having been founded by abolitionists, continuing that model, putting forward the alternatives and the principled ideas and opinions and trying to influence public opinion. And I also, picking up on Eric's hope that Obama, like Lincoln, can be open-minded and moved by the agitation and ideas of our time, I'm pleased to report that Obama does have a subscription to The Nation. So this is a first step. So thank you. And it's been a pleasure hearing from all of you on the call today. I'm sorry we could take only a handful of the many questions that I know we got, but maybe we will revisit this. And just briefly, I want to remind you that March is membership month at The Nation. This magazine has survived not just from 1865, but from the Great Depression to this Great Recession, and we need your help more than ever. Our goal is to add 2,000 new members to the rolls of our Nation associates by midnight, March 31st. So if you're not a member, please join. And if you don't know it, Nation associates allow us to do the kind of reporting and thinking and journalism we do. You provide more than 20% of all of our revenues at the magazine. So please join. And if once you're a member, we'll invite you to more of these members-only conference calls, like the extraordinary one today. And please visit thenation.com/donate for more information. And thank you again, Eric.
You're very welcome.
Phone call.
Most enjoyable.
Tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you all.
Okay. Thanks to everyone for taking part.
Bye-bye.
So long.